This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. It's summer, a time on the new planet Earth for more high temperature records in the Northern Hemisphere. Others nearly drown in global wetting. We are all at the mercy of the great stalled waves of the jet stream, my friends. The new normal is there is no normal. The high Arctic ice is melting, more or less unreported. Canadian cities notice the great clouds of smoke coming from the burning boreal forests of the north, unquenched, unseen except by satellite. The same in Russia. Deadly superfires, as predicted on Radio EcoShock, are already with us. It's a perfect time for The Burning Question, a new book by carbon footprint expert, author, and Guardian journalist Mike Berners-Lee. His co-author is a consultant editor for the environment section of the UK's Guardian newspaper and a visiting researcher at the UCL Energy Institute. The authors conclude, the next economic crash may come when the fossil fuel companies are forced to revalue drastically downward. Why? If the public cannot stomach a climate of extinction, more than half of the fossil fuel reserves of the world must stay in the ground. It's shocking, but it's true. Only the business community, pushed by a worried public, can force the politicians into the global agreements we need to ensure our survival. So far, Berners-Lee and Clark say neither conferences, energy efficiency, or alternative energy have had any effect in slowing down the year-by-year growth of greenhouse gas emissions. We find out more in this feature-length interview of Mike Berners-Lee by UK writer and journalist Greg Moffat. Greg has written for the BBC and other publications. Now Moffat has a regular online radio podcast out of the United Kingdom. He calls it Legalize Freedom. As I head out for the hills for my summer vacation, let's listen in as guest host Greg Moffat turns to the burning question.
LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Mike Berners-Lee, co-author of a new book entitled The Burning Question: We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal and Gas, So How Do We Quit? Climate change is the most fascinating scientific, political and social puzzle of our time. Great minds, enthusiastic leaders and green warriors have all tried to tackle the problem, but so far, the world's efforts at reducing global warming have failed. We do our best to save energy, and technologies have made burning fuels more efficient, but the simple fact is, carbon emissions are still accelerating upwards, following an exponential curve that goes back centuries. Like squeezing a balloon, reductions in one place lead to increases elsewhere. The real barrier to action is that the world has far more fossil fuel in its reserves than it can safely burn. At least twice as much, and perhaps 10 times as much. These reserves are worth tens of trillions of dollars, and solving the problem means persuading the world to abandon them. The burning question asks whether that's possible, and what the side effects might be. Would the global economy sink, and oil companies crash as the carbon bubble bursts? Or could we transition smoothly to a green future? Looking at the whole issue from a fresh perspective, The Burning Question argues that global warming can still be tackled, but only if humankind wakes up to the threat and demands that the fuels stay in the ground. Hello and welcome, Mike, and thank you very much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hi.
Mike, today we're going to discuss your new book, which you've co-authored with Duncan Clark, and it's called The Burning Question, subtitle, We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal and Gas, So How Do We Quit? And you point out early in the book that basically human history is essentially history of energy, our relationship with and use of it. Increasingly, in the end of 20th century into the early years of the 21st, we're experiencing a lot of problems around energy, energy security, supply. We see prices for domestic and industrial users climbing. I mean, oil is off its all-time peak, but the trend seems to be in more or less in one direction. And we do need to do something to wean ourselves off our addiction to oil. Difficult, of course, because our industrial civilization depends on it. There's issues around renewables and nuclear, perhaps not showing the promise that we hoped. And of course, there's a threat from global warming, climate change, call it whatever you will. And this, the first stark fact in the book that you present is that for the layperson, it's easy to think that with all this, these issues facing us, that they, quote-unquote, experts are doing something about this. But in fact, fossil fuel use and emissions have both been rising exponentially for more than a century. Now, how on earth do we explain that?
So when we wrote this book because we, out of a sense that some of the big picture analysis of what's the sort of global systemic phenomenon of climate change hadn't properly been flushed out, that wasn't popularly understood. So we set out to write a very big picture analysis, looking, you know, originally we even thought about calling the book The View from Mars because it was taking a very big picture view on it. And when you do that, one of the first things you spot is that global emissions have been rising exponentially since 1850, which is when we've got records from, or decent records, probably before that. And by exponentially, I mean that they've been averaging out at about 1.8% growth per year, every year. And occasionally there have been a few years that are a bit higher than that, but they're always followed by a few years that are a bit lower. It's a remarkably predictable exponential curve. That actually tells us a few very important things. So the first thing it tells us, as you point out, is that nothing that humankind has done to try and cut those emissions has made any detectable difference to that curve. So none of the talk about climate change, none of the global politics about climate change, none of the energy efficiency, none of the national targets or anything like that, that we all hope might be at least beginning to make a difference. None of that has made any detectable difference whatsoever to this very predictable rising exponential curve. So that's the first thing that it tells us. But it also tells us some other equally important things. It tells us that it's likely that energy efficiency isn't going to be, on its own, isn't going to be the solution. Because if you look back over the last 150 years, actually, that's a story of increasing energy efficiency and innovation around energy that's been going on all the time. So 150 years ago, we were using candles, and now we're using LED light bulbs. 150 years ago, we were using coal to drive steam engines, and now we're harnessing energy far, far more efficiently than that. So the kind of popular and obvious thought that an efficiency improvement might cut our overall consumption of energy and maybe our overall need to dig fossil fuel out of the ground is understandable. But in actual fact, when you look at it a bit more closely, it turns out not to be right. The way the dynamic goes, it looks far more likely that actually the more efficiency we've got, the more we find ourselves wanting to use energy because it becomes more useful, and the better able we are to go and dig fuel out of the ground. And so actually, the process of improving our efficiency has actually been feeding that dynamic of increased energy consumption. So that doesn't mean that, that doesn't tell us that efficiency is a bad thing, but it does tell us that on its own, it leads to increased rather than decreased consumption. And the predictability of the curve, the 1.8% a year with, you know, plus or minus not very much, tells us that there's a very fundamental global dynamic at play, in which energy begets energy, and it's like a snowball. Just the bigger it is, the bigger it gets. So we need a different kind of approach to do, if we want to crack that curve, we need a different kind of approach from the sorts of solutions that are usually talked about.
Now, of course, first thought, you don't have to be a mathematical expert, but first thought about exponential curves is that they don't go on forever. So where is this likely to end up? Not so much in terms of all the broad consequences, but just looking at the numbers of this and this way this trend is going.
Well, as you say, all exponentials come to an end. So we know for sure that we're going to be coming off that exponential curve within 600 years, because if we stayed on it for 600 years, we'd be burning all the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere every single year. So that's clearly ridiculous and impossible. But coming forward to a sort of shorter timescale, we're pretty sure that within 100 years, even if our expectations about what we might discover in the ground, the new discoveries we might make, even if they exceed our expectations, within the next 100 years, we'd run out of everything, every scrap of coal, oil and gas. So we're definitely coming off it in the next 100 years. But actually, you can take that timescale in quite a bit further, because if you look at all the climate change predictions for 2 degrees, 3 degrees and 4 degrees, and nobody knows for certain what sort of temperature is caused by what kind of cumulative carbon emissions, but it looks pretty clear that unless we leave the vast majority of the fuel that we already know about and are already gearing up to extract in the ground, probably for all time, we are at very high risk of taking the temperature to temperature rises which are going to be very dangerous for our species.
Now, we'll come back to the economics and politics of leaving fossil fuels in the ground in a moment, but perhaps you can say something about an all-time carbon budget, because that was a new phrase, a new idea to me.
So there are lots of the exact dynamics of how carbon emissions relate to the climate. It's quite complicated. There are different gases that we put up into the atmosphere, of which the most important one is carbon dioxide. And the more we put up into the atmosphere, the more it drives the greenhouse effect. But equally, there are various compensatory mechanisms that the Earth responds, but there are also positive feedback mechanisms. So there are a range of quite complicated effects. But one quite good approximation is to say that actually, in terms of the eventual equilibrium peak temperature that we'll arrive at, it doesn't much matter when we burn the carbon dioxide. What matters is the total amount that we've burned ever. And the numbers turned out to be pretty good round numbers, in that it looks as though for a 50% chance of staying within 2 degrees centigrade, we need to make sure that we stay within an all-time limit of a trillion tons of carbon, of which we've burned the majority already.
Now, this 2-degree limit that was agreed at the Copenhagen summit in 2009, I believe, but this is all still, as you've alluded to, against a background of great uncertainty, because the climate on the planet, which has always changed naturally, is an incredibly complex system with so many inputs and variables, you know, natural and artificial.
Yes, that's true. I think, you know, for all the numbers that get quoted around about different levels of emissions causing different temperature rises and so on, we need to keep very firmly in mind that actually all this is actually very uncertain. And for all the best modelling in the world, and there's a range of models, and you can take the average of them and so on, and they all try and predict different probabilities of different temperature rises and so on. But the simple truth that they all tell us is that we don't really know for sure the ins and outs of all that. And what we do know is that the more carbon we put into the atmosphere, the more risk we're exposed to. We know those risks are very, very serious. And at a best estimate, if we want a 75% chance of staying within 2 degrees, then we need to keep the vast majority of the fossil fuels that we already know about in the ground for all time.
Now, some people have mentioned a few potential positives in if we take climate change as to read global warming, and you look at some of the potential effects in the book under the headings The Good, The Bad, and somewhat more worryingly, The Beast.
Yes, that's right. So it's easy to think if you live in a fairly chilly and wet part of the world, then it's tempting to think that a couple of degrees temperature rise could be quite nice for some people. But of course, actually, what that means for the whole world's weather systems and what that means for the carrying capacity of the world in terms of its ability to produce food, for example, it's almost certain, especially as you get over 2 degrees, it's almost certain that that's starting to lead to quite serious reductions, for example, in the fertility of the world's land.
Of course, you mentioned that we've got centuries left of fossil fuels, which, of course, one of your key arguments is we can't afford to actually burn those. But centuries are not the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, you know, that oil and other fossil fuels that was easiest to get, of course, was used up first. But we see now some quite extreme things going on. We hear a lot about the dash for gas and shale oil and other conventional sources. And, of course, I recently did a show all about fracking.
And all of those methods, some of the dirtier ones, they have great environmental side effects as well. But they do speak to our addiction and our need for these things. It's almost like any lengths, even though the net energy, you know, energy used up to actually get hold of these fuels, that balance is not always taken into account.
Yes, that's right. So, if you look at the fuel that's in the ground, there's some fuel that we know about and we're pretty confident that it's currently commercially viable to dig out of the ground, and we call those proven reserves. And then there are possible reserves, which there's a probability that they'll be commercially viable at some point. And then there are known resources, which are fuels that we know where they are, but includes fuels that we know about but we don't think are yet commercially viable to get out of the ground. And of course, there's a continuing process of discovery of more fuel and finding out ways in which fuel that used to be uncommercial to get out of the ground can actually become commercial. And as the price, if the price of fuel goes up, then of course that changes the balance and it becomes more worth making more of an effort to go to tap into different reserves. And if you develop a new technology such as tar sands or fracking, then that opens up a whole new set of fuel. So that process is going on all the time, and the total pot that we've got available to us is growing all the time. So the last thing we need is more innovation to get even smarter at accessing some of the harder-to-reach reserves, which, of course, is a process which we're currently investing globally. We're investing a lot of money in.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock's Summer Showcase. This week we are listening to a special online radio podcast called Legalize Freedom with Greg Moffat. Greg is interviewing UK journalist and carbon expert Mike Berners-Lee. The topic is the new book, The Burning Question: We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal, and Gas, So How Do We Quit?
For those of us in the UK and large parts of Europe, the US, Australia, places like that, and particularly here in the UK, if you lived through the 1980s, miners' strike, it's easy to sort of dismiss coal in our imagination as something that really just isn't a fuel source in any meaningful way anymore. But we look at some of the emerging economies, and particularly China, and some very surprising statistics in your book about the increased use of coal, which, of course, is very dirty.
Yeah, we all think that maybe the carbon intensity of our energy is improving because in this country, at least in the developed world, we hear about renewables and energy efficiency the whole time. It would be very easy to think that the world's energy mix was improving. But actually, if you look at the carbon intensity of the world's energy, it's pretty well flatlining. We think that, if anything, in the last 10 years, it's actually got worse. And the reason for that is that to a very great extent, the developing economies are powered by the most carbon-intensive fuels, and that's coal.
In many ways, fossil fuels compared to, say, for example, other fuels that we've used, like wood, fossil fuels are quite unique in their characteristics and very difficult, if not impossible, to replace. And we have built, since the Industrial Revolution, we have built an enormous and growing infrastructure, including the built environment, transport systems, manufacturing, all the way we provide heat and light, all of which is dependent on oil or other fossil fuels. Now, some of this, it may be possible to convert, but much of it will end up being, if we go in the direction that you're advocating, will end up being obsolete. And there's also the energy cost of actually converting or replacing that. Some experts say it's too late, for example, to use the oil that we would need to convert to solar.
Yeah, that's right. If you take the view that we have to leave, and I think it's increasingly amongst people who really think about this and get to grips with the numbers, I think it's no longer even controversial in some circles now that we need to leave fuel in the ground. If you take the view that we need a global deal that cuts the rate at which fossil fuel is taken out of the ground, which looks absolutely clear, then the question is, well, why is it so hard to bring that deal about? Why are we so wedded to extracting this stuff that it's clearly going to be harmful to do? And one of the answers turns out is that it's worth so much money. So there are tens of trillions of dollars of fuel reserves in the ground, and those reserves are owned by companies who want to dig it up and sell it. And they're owned by countries who balance their books using it. And the UK did that for a while, and America definitely does it. And a host of countries do that. And then on top of the value of the fuel themselves, as you say, there's all the infrastructure. We actually think the infrastructure problem is less serious than the value of the reserves itself. A lot of the infrastructure will go out of date in its own time anyway and will need replacing, and so can be replaced with something that's fit for a low-carbon world. Some of the remaining infrastructure will be adaptable at a cost, but not 100% cost. It may be cheaper than throwing it away and starting from scratch. And even if you have to take something apart, I mean, Hadrian's Wall is still being used. You know, the bricks from Hadrian's Wall are still in houses that are being lived in today. So, you know, it's not 100% write-off even in that case. So we don't think the infrastructure write-off, we think it's serious, but we don't think it's a showstopper.
Now, I think most people will be aware that renewables aren't an unalloyed good. There are issues there. One of them being that they're all actually quite oil intensive in their own way, surprisingly so. It seems somewhat counterintuitive. Nuclear in particular, not only in the wake of Fukushima, but there's always been the issue of how to store and how to potentially process the waste products from that. And I know you mentioned thorium reactors, but there's a question as to whether those, even after all these decades of research, can actually be viable. And then with solar and wind, you know, we get simple protests along the lines of, you know, not in our backyard with wind turbines. And we have solar. I mean, Germany seems to be the only developed country that's doing anything meaningful along solar lines. We had here in the UK, for example, last year that the government's solar panel subsidy was so successful they cancelled it, which was bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, we hear a lot about renewables, and of course they're a good thing. But in the scheme of the world's energy supply, they are an absolute speck. And frankly, for the foreseeable future, that's about where they look as though they're going to be. So it's not realistic to think that in the next few decades, which is the timescale in which we need to turn our carbon emissions around, we're going to suddenly be able to replace our fossil fuel with renewables. That's not to say it isn't a good idea to push the button on them as hard as we can, but we should be realistic about what they can and can't deliver. As far as the nuclear question goes, I think the details of the policy decision about what the role of nuclear is incredibly complex. Clearly, it's a question of balancing up costs and opportunities and risks, you know, against the alternatives. What would happen if you invested your effort into the alternatives? And I think unless you really roll up your sleeves and do a lot of homework on the specifics of that analysis, it's actually quite difficult to take a position on it. But what I would say about it is this, that the nuclear debate has attracted entrenched positions for decades on both sides. And what we'd urge everybody to do is throw away all their preconceptions about the nuclear argument, because the traditional arguments, as they stood even 10 years ago or certainly 20 years ago, have now changed completely, because we've got a climate change threat that is really big and needs to be taken very, very seriously indeed. And meanwhile, some of the threats around nuclear seem to have mitigated somewhat, and then there's a whole cost equation. It looks as though nuclear is actually quite costly. But I think rather than take a very firm view on it, I think what I'd just encourage is for everybody to be really open-minded, whatever camp you've been on, you know, for the last few decades, however wedded you feel to pro or against nuclear, just we all need to reevaluate that argument.
A lot of the names will be familiar to us, Rio, Tokyo, Copenhagen, and you point out to date there's been something like 18 international climate summits using, I would point out, a lot of CO2. With their private jets, five-star hotels and lobster thermidor or whatever they're having. But there's been a top-down failure, and we see this in the area of energy and climate change. It's almost expected, because we see international summits, for example, now on the financial crisis, and we kind of expect these leaders to get together and kind of shuffle papers for a couple of weeks and go home and achieve very little. But one of the other things, again, that's counterintuitive in the book that you point out is for the bottom-up approach that a lot of people are advocating, that, well, we have to start changing individually and, as you know, in a local community level. These things have a negligible impact, but that's not to say that we shouldn't do them.
No, exactly. I think we want to be very clear about what we're saying here, because I think what we're not saying is we shouldn't do them. And in fact, our conclusion is, in the end, our conclusion is that it is even more important than ever that we do all that kind of stuff at a local scale and more. And the reason is this. So it's clear that we need a global deal on the fossil fuel that comes out of the ground, to cap the fossil fuel that comes out of the ground. And once you accept that conclusion, everything revolves around the question of what would it take to create the conditions under which such a deal would be possible. Now, at the moment, it's clear that the political process is completely lacking, and it's unhelpful. I've heard one or two UK politicians recently saying, OK, we all think the global process isn't going very far, but actually it is showing some signs of beginning to get somewhere. And I think in the context of where it needs to get to, compared to what those signs of progress might be, I think we need to keep a very clear perspective that it really is absolutely nowhere near, even beginning, to look as though it might be leading towards the kind of deal that we need. So the current political process is nothing like what is required. So the question is, what would it take to bring about the conditions under which such a political process really could start to work in a way that might deliver what we need? And when you start asking those questions, I think it takes you to the point of saying, well, how can we bring about a situation in which politicians the world over are fearing for their political careers if they don't get that deal? And they aren't seen to be pushing so hard for that deal that they're part of the reason why it comes about. And what would it take for a politician to feel like that? Well, they probably need to understand that their electorate doesn't just have an armchair concern about it, the kind of concern where when somebody comes up to you with a questionnaire on the street and says, are you concerned about climate change? You say yes. That's not the kind of concern we're talking about. We're talking about the kind of concern where it's actually palpable, that it's finding its way into your behaviours as proof that it will find its way into how you vote. And there needs to be a sense that everybody cares about this stuff. And probably the only way of showing that in a way that is believable is by doing it.
Well, of course, the issue here is that at all levels, nobody wants to give anything up fundamentally. I mean, we see that now since the financial crisis of 07, 08, that even with relatively modest austerity, for example, here in the UK, we see quite out of proportion reactions from the people and also from political leaders on various sides and immediate calls to get back to growth, which is one of the problems.
Yes, I think this whole debate gets unhelpfully framed up around giving things up, because overall, there's no reason why this needs to be a giving up kind of agenda. It's not as though the way that we do life at the moment is fine-tuned for maximizing human well-being. There's plenty of human activity that goes on which trashes the planet and delivers absolutely nothing for human well-being. So yes, it's a time of change. We do need to look at the way we do life in some respects, but the idea that overall it's going to be some cost to how good the experience of being alive is, I think it's misplaced. So there's strong evidence that, at least in the developed world, their economic growth doesn't correlate at all well with well-being. It's not that economic growth is an irrelevant measure, but it's being used for the wrong things. So it's being used as a proxy for everything that matters to us. And it absolutely isn't that, and that is part of the problem. I think it's worth talking about the business case as well, because we hear a lot about the business threat from climate change. So there are certainly some sections of industry that feel a very strong threat to the idea of a cap on the rate of combustion of fossil fuel. So in particular, the oil industry.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock's Summer Showcase. This week we are listening to a special online radio podcast called Legalize Freedom with Greg Moffat. Greg is interviewing UK journalist and carbon expert Mike Berners-Lee. The topic is the new book, The Burning Question: We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal, and Gas, So How Do We Quit? We'll be right back.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Let's return to author Mike Berners-Lee as he talks with Greg Moffat about leaving half of all the fossil fuel resources in the ground.
And it's pretty clear that there are hundreds of millions of dollars have been pumped into creating confusion over what the science is, and propaganda, spurious skeptic propaganda, and misleading the whole world over over the climate change agenda. And that looks as though that's come from a part of the business community that sees a very obvious threat, because there are assets that may need writing off, will need writing off, and have responded to that. But what hasn't, I don't think, been adequately grasped is that actually there's a massive business opportunity out there as well. So there are plenty of businesses who have a strong commercial interest in pushing for a global deal on capping emissions. I'll just explain a bit about where that comes from. So at the moment, if humankind wants to have more utility of anything, it's got two basic routes that it can go down in order to have more. It can either burn through more resources, just dig more fuel and other resources out of the ground to use them up, and then it can have more stuff and do more things and travel more and burn more energy and all the rest of it. And the other way of doing it is to become smarter and more efficient at creating things and doing things, and to innovate new ways of doing it. So at the moment, there are two ways of having more, and we tend to do a bit of both. We become more efficient, and we also burn through more resources. If we cap the resource that we use, then suddenly, if we want to maintain or grow our utility, there's only one way of doing it, and that is to become more efficient, or to become smarter, or to invent a new way of doing something. So if you are in the business of innovation and efficiency, let's say you're an ICT business or you're any number of businesses, actually a cap on fossil fuel use is a massive business opportunity potentially. And if you look at where the company value is going to go, if oil companies lose out by writing off some of their assets, then that shareholder value is going to shift to somewhere. So that opportunity that faces many, many businesses is a card that I don't even think it's been properly noticed yet. And it's certainly not a card that's been played properly yet. So there ought to be a big faction of the business community, at least, pushing hard for a global deal, even if it's purely for the sake of their own commercial interest.
Well, such action then, that would raise a huge question about the value of put on the oil industry and in the assets in the ground. And of course, we think about how important the energy industry, you know, to the conventional energy industry is to the world, not just in the ways we've been talking about, but from the point of view of investments, because they generate a lot of income streams for a lot of people that may not even realize they're benefiting from it. It could be a pensioner sitting at in their front room somewhere in Croydon and not realize that a chunk of their pension investment is in Statoil or whatever, and that's how they get paid. And that could really be a game changer.
It's a good point that the vested interest in that, the value of that fossil fuel, is spread throughout, especially throughout the developed world. So, and it touches us all. So if you ever invest any money in anything, unless you're very, very careful about how you invest it, it's almost certainly going to have some fossil fuels tied up in it. And it's all our countries, and some more than others, though. So yeah, it's very widely dispersed, the value in the fossil fuel. But don't forget, supposing you've invested in a pension fund, and there's a portfolio behind that, the lost assets in the fossil fuel are going to shift to somewhere else. So that may well also be in your portfolio.
Now, I do very much agree with your earlier point about, GDP and growth, these other metrics being used crudely to somehow measure our happiness, which they don't reflect. And I do think that the consumer culture that we live in the West, and actually increasingly in some of the emerging economies, is a big part of the problem. It's actually a psychological problem in a way that we invest our hopes for our happiness in, plasma screen TVs and cars and bigger houses. And we do this because we're basically working with faulty information, obsolete paradigms. Governments and media, of course, they perpetuate this in our minds. So it's kind of a vicious circle of delusion, basically.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they're only ever substitutes for the things that really make us happy most of the time. And that's right that we're locked into that mindset. And I think that's right that it's a cultural thing. And it's also propelled by a multi-billion pound industry that encourages us to think that way. So one of the things we talk about in the book is we have a little graphic of three carriages of a train, and one carriage is the extraction carriage, so that's all the fuel getting dredged up out of the ground, and attached to that is the combustion carriage, which is where the fuel gets burned, some of it in households, but a lot of it in industry, in the course of making all the stuff that we buy. And then the final carriage is the consumption carriage. So you can attribute all the fossil fuel emissions or all the greenhouse gas emissions to human consumption. And if you add up the extraction, it turns out to be just about the same number as the figure you'd get if you added up all the combustion. and it's just about the same number you'd get if you added up the emissions attributed to human consumption. So all those three carriages travel at exactly the same speed. So if you try to put the brakes on the consumption carriage by encouraging people to have lower carbon lifestyles, for example, what you're up against is that the coupling with the combustion carriage is pretty strong. You've got all the businesses who are making their living out of creating enough stuff, as much stuff as they can, and persuading you to buy it. They're coupled to the consumption carriage through, you know, all the marketing and PR and advertising and all the rest of it that's encouraging you to think that you've got to have more stuff. And in turn, the businesses that are making all this stuff are coupled to the extraction carriage by the fossil fuel companies, who have an interest in making sure that they sell their fossil fuel to somewhere and that market is alive and healthy. So we actually need to work on all those things together. And in terms of the culture of consumption, the consumerist culture, I think one of the questions that I don't think we have a clear answer to is how much of the way we currently do life is fundamentally unfit for purpose and needs reinventing, and how much of it is fundamentally okay and it's fit for purpose, but we just need to make one or two structural changes and then carry on as before. So, for example, if we could bring about a global deal on fossil fuel extraction, then you could argue that we could still have a consumerist society and everyone could still be clamoring for as much stuff as they could get their hands on. And actually, it wouldn't matter in terms of the overall global environmental impact, because although one person's excessive consumption would deny somebody else maybe having enough, it wouldn't make any difference to the total carbon footprint of human consumption. So there's one argument would say, look, if we could just get the cap on emissions, then we could just let the consumerist culture carry on and do its own thing, and it'll be fine. But another argument says, actually, you'll never succeed in getting that cap without doing something about the consumer culture first, because we've got to bring about the conditions in which everybody's prepared to have the cap so that the politicians fight for it. And linked to that, there's another argument that says, actually, you know what? The consumer culture never made us happy anyway, so let's just ditch it. Let's ditch it anyway, and here's an opportunity to do so. And I think finding our way through that debate, I think we all have instincts about it. And I talk to people who think climate change is a big deal, but they don't really think we should tamper with the consumer culture much. And I also talk to people who have always believed that consumer culture is rotten at the core and has never really served us very well, and climate change just gives us one more good reason for ditching it. And that's probably, in my heart of hearts, that's probably where I come from in all this instinctively. But I don't think it's proven that we definitely need to reinvent the consumer culture in order to crack climate change.
So many mixed messages then, and contrary to what, you know, consumer culture, what business and advertising are telling us, there's the message which, you know, politicians will get up and completely counter their talk about growth, and depending on what the, you know, the purpose of their press conference is, and they will say that it is an imperative that we do something about climate change. It is the biggest threat that we're facing. But in your phrase in the book is, there's just enough abstraction, complexity and long-term uncertainty around all of the science and other things, you know, connected to it, for us, you know, as humans, we like to do this just to push the problem off to another day, kick it into the long grass, and that they, as I mentioned earlier in quotes, somewhere down the line, technology, some genius, an Einstein type figure will, you know, it'll all get worked out in the end. Because after all, we've come through a lot of problems, you know, the last 10,000 years hasn't exactly been without tumult. So here we are. So the idea is that, you know, the march of progress, the myth of progress, it must be, you know, it must go on.
Yeah, I think that argument that we'll be okay because we've always been okay for the last 10,000 years is hilarious when you look at it, actually. Because, you know, what every species that has ever existed on the planet could say that about itself until the day when it came extinct. So it's actually a completely there's no evidence whatsoever in the notion that we've always been okay so far. So that tells us nothing at all about whether we'll be okay through this. The psychology of human denial is fascinating and critically important. So we called our book The Burning Question, and ask the burning question, how can we leave the fossil fuel in the ground? But perhaps the burning question, the real burning question behind the burning question at face value, is how on earth can humankind really wake up to this. I mean, it is a massive threat. It's clear it's a massive threat. And yet we're sleepwalking into it. I mean, all of us, even those of us who say we care about it, you know, who can really say that their own response to it is in keeping with the scale of the challenge we're up against? And it's precious few of us. So how can we wake up? The psychology of human denial is well documented, and it's a fairly well understood phenomenon that if a human being gets a bit of bad news, we go through a bit of a curve. It's sometimes described as a transition curve or a change curve, where the first thing we do is deny it, and then we get angry about it, and then we get depressed about it, and then we kind of sit down and come to terms with it, and we face up to the reality of the situation. And then finally, at that point, we can start picking up the pieces and working out what to do about things. And, you know, humans go through that process virtually every time they encounter a bit of bad news. So if you're driving a car along the motorway and you run out of petrol, you go through exactly that process in a short space of time. First of all, you don't believe it, so you stamp your foot up and down on the accelerator a bit to see if you can get any life out of the car. And then you maybe pull over in the hard shoulder and thump the steering wheel a few times because you got cross about it. And then you get all depressed and you sort of slump down in your seat and you just think how awful the world is. I can't believe this has happened to me. And then finally, you come to terms with it, and then you start doing sensible things like ringing up the breakdown company or whatever. In something like that, it takes us 30 seconds or something to get through the curve. But when it's a very big piece of very difficult, abstract news about some problem that's going to hit us, not in the next 5 minutes, but in decades to come, and might affect our children more than it affects ourselves, and it's about this gas that you can't even see, and it's about some global thing that you have to trust a whole load of scientists about. And we've just got so much wriggle room for avoiding it and finding ways of not fully facing up to it. We find ourselves convincing ourselves that the proof that we don't have to face up to it properly is that we've been denying it and life still feels fine. And the problem is this is something that will hit us in the future. And when you run out of fuel on the motorway, that's a problem that you don't spend a long time in denial, because the reality of the situation hits you in a very, very tangible and immediate way. And we don't have the luxury of that strong feedback loop with climate change. We have to anticipate what is going to happen in decades to come. So we have to get a strong emotional response now to an uncertain risk that in a not very many decades' time, we might go over a tipping point, which might lead to a catastrophic change in the climate, maybe even a few decades on from that. And we need to care enough about that it makes us take strong action today. And that is the sort of challenge that maybe humans have never had to respond to before. You know, we're capable of galvanizing whole communities and countries into very strong action. So the old analogy, but I think it's a good one, is to say, well, what happened when the Second World War came around? This country got very strongly galvanized into all kinds of action, and we learned how to crack codes and create bombs, and we got radar working and all sorts of things in a very, very short space of time. But we understood the threat, and it was a much more tangible threat. And somehow we have the challenge for us now is, how could we understand the threat at an emotional level with the same strength that we understood the threat in the late 30s and 40s? And that's a question which I think, you know, nobody knows the answer to. Nobody knows for sure what is the answer to how can humankind wake up. Just because we don't know the answer doesn't mean there isn't one, doesn't mean we can't do it. But arguably, that is the most important burning question behind the obvious burning question.
Perhaps if we believed that Martians were changing the climate as a way to attack us, that we might be able to get behind some action. Taking that level of psychology into account.
Well, we wriggle around with all sorts of... The trouble with anything uncertain, you know, the human mind wriggles away from bad news as hard as it can. And the trouble with abstractions and uncertainties is they give you so much wriggle room. And we need to find a way of not getting derailed by that.
Well, of course, even if you were someone who dismissed the threat of climate change, basically that, yes, the climate changes, but it's not caused by human activity, unless you're then a believer also in abiotic oil, for example, and this just for people who don't know, it's this theory that oil within the earth actually generates itself, you know, constantly, it's renewing itself, you'd have to be a believer in that. If you're not, then there's still the issue of the supply of fossil fuels, you know, because you pointed out, of course, we can't afford to burn them for environmental reasons, but there's still the other big issue, which, well, yeah, but they're limited. So if they had no environmental impact, they'd still run out at some point. And that is also massive issue.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I've just, a colleague of mine has just written a book about the impact of the scarcity of oil. And we've had a bit of a debate about, you know, is the problem one of scarcity or one of abundance? In terms of fossil fuel, the problem is one of abundance. There's no doubt about it. There's too much of the stuff, and we need to have the discipline to voluntarily leave it in the ground. If you take the question of oil specifically, and you take the view that oil is a very particular kind of fossil fuel that has got use applications that coal will never have. So, for example, we don't think foreseeably that you're going to be able to get the energy from coal and use it to power aeroplanes. To date, we haven't really cracked how to use coal to power cars. But the electric car solves that one. If you take the view that oil's not particularly fundamentally all that special amongst fossil fuels, then the problem is definitely only one of abundance. And the idea of running out is cuckoo land. But if you take the view that oil is a very special fossil fuel and that we absolutely need to be able to burn oil to power our cars and planes, then it's possible that you could put together an argument for some sort of scarcity problem with oil at the same time as a problem of abundance of the other fossil fuels. In the end, I don't think I'd go a long way with that argument because there's too much in the tar sands and we're discovering too much of it all the time and we're getting better and better at using, in the end, finding ways of doing with coal what we used to only be able to do with oil, such as drive cars. And there's always biofuels which create a hideous problem for the food system. But for all those reasons, I don't think the scarcity problem is the big deal. The problem is abundance.
I think that the debt-based monetary system that most of the world operates under is a problem here in a couple of ways. One, because it demands perpetual growth, and we're seeing all the problems with that model since the crash of 2007-08. But also the attempts to address the problems stemming from that. The focus is, in many ways, is shifted away from climate change. It's off a lot of people's agendas because of what's going on with banking.
Yes, I think that's right. So one of the dilemmas that, for example, Tim Jackson is wrestling with is how can you have a stable economic system that doesn't have growth? Because the whole way that it's wired up at the moment is, as you say, stems from the idea that businesses get in debt and the way that they manage themselves is to grow their way out of debt and because debts need servicing and so on. But I think it's an interesting idea that if you were able to do away with the idea of interest on loans, for example, if you could do away with that completely, then that whole idea of debt feeding the need for growth might go. But that's a big reinvention of the economic system. And that's another one of those questions which we ask but we explore in the book, but we don't have, in the end, the final answer to, is how much of the way that we do economics is fundamentally unfit for purpose. Some people say, you've got to have growth. You've got to have a growth-based economy. Nothing else will work, and only people who wear sandals and smoke roll-ups will ever contemplate anything different. And other people will say that economic growth is fundamentally unhelpful. To have an economic model which needs to have growth in all societies is fundamentally unhelpful, and we've got to move away from it. And I think one conclusion we come to is that economic growth, at least in developed countries, is overvalued. We put too much importance on it. We should be asking other questions that are much more important than the one of economic growth. And we've got locked into some kind of very rigid thinking around that we would do well to break out of. But the other conclusion we came to is that it's very unproven whether or not you could have growth in a carbon-constrained world. So there are some people saying that we've never managed to decouple economic growth from growth in emissions, and that's true. We've never been able to grow economies without growing emissions, and we're miles away from ever achieving that. At a global level, we're miles away from achieving that. It doesn't even look hopeful that we could be even moving anywhere towards that. But let's ask the question another way around. If we were to cap fossil fuels, would economic growth become possible? And our answer to that is that it probably would, actually, because at the end of the day, economic growth is just about money, and money is a human construct. And if you cap the fossil fuel, the way that value moves around the society will change. Different businesses will be the ones that grow. The link between economic growth and energy will be broken. And whilst there might be a bit of a hiccup in the economy whilst everyone gets used to a new way of working under a new constraint, we don't think it's at all proven that economic growth, for what it's worth, wouldn't be possible. In fact, we think it's probably likely. If it's what humans really wanted, we're pretty ingenious species, we'd probably find a way.
Turning to earlier decades, we saw upheaval in the energy market, specifically in the 1970s, the oil shocks there. A lot of writers, particularly today, are looking back at that, whether they lived through that period or not, as something of a missed opportunity to do something about the fossil fuel dependency.
Climate change and fossil fuel dependency weren't on the radar with the seriousness that they are now or anything like it. And the oil crisis back then was totally unplanned. It was just a situation that we found ourselves in and we had to respond to. And so possibly it was a missed opportunity, but I guess we shouldn't beat ourselves up about it because we didn't realize that that was an opportunity we needed to grasp. I think there are some interesting examples from history of times when there's been a constraint on energy use and how that's been coped with. So one example in particular, and I hesitate to say this because the country I'm about to mention is so politically loaded that the minute you mention it, everybody immediately polarizes themselves. They're either going to agree or disagree with what I'm about to say just because of the name of the country. But if you look at what happened in Cuba, they found themselves in a situation where they had to constrain their energy use. They didn't do it voluntarily. The constraint on energy use was imposed upon them, but they managed it. And what's really interesting about it is that, as far as we can tell, it didn't get in the way of well-being. You know, it didn't get in the way of life expectancy. It didn't get in the way of whatever your measures of well-being are. Having to live under the energy constraint didn't interrupt well-being. In fact, they've got pretty good life expectancy and so on. And there are lots of things about life in Cuba that, you know, that are quite good. I'm not going to, you know, describe it as some utopian perfect society. But I think it does tell us that if we did have the discipline to impose the global cap on fossil fuel, it wouldn't get in the way of how good it is to be alive.
Now, the 1970s was also a time when the issue of population came to the fore, books such as The Limits to Growth being published, yep. You had the establishment of the Club of Rome, and even in popular culture, films like Soylent Green and Zero Population Growth, and there was very much a feeling that it was, you know, around about the year 1999 that everything was going to collapse. But the serious message behind that was being that we couldn't carry on the way we were going. And yet we have, in terms of fossil fuel use and emissions. But the population picture, although it is controversial, it will need to be addressed. It's not quite as simple as we might all think it is.
No, it's not. And population is clearly a dimension of this. The more people there are, the more we need to share the resources around. But it's an example of a curve that used to be exponential and isn't anymore. It's more like linear at the moment, and it looks as though it's going to tail off, and it looks as though it's going to come to, if all our other things stay stable and we don't suffer any environmental catastrophes or anything, it looks as though it'll top out somewhere around the 9 or 10 billion mark. It looks as though that's a story of things sort of naturally managing themselves. It looks as though when societies acquire a certain level of affluence, they get to the point where people choose not to have more than a certain number of kids. Unfortunately, the point at which people start making choices to have smaller families also turns out to be the point at which they start having really high carbon lifestyles. And the two effects kind of counterbalance each other out. So if you take a country as a whole, the point at which it stops its population growth is not the same as the point at which it stops its carbon emissions, because all that happens is the static population starts picking up the slack by growing its footprint of each person that bit faster. So the population equation is a complicated one. Again, one of the simple things you can say about it is that it looks as though it is definitely, from all perspectives, unhelpful for people who don't want to have a child to end up having one. If there are any sort of simple nuggets that it's possible to distill out of all the complexities around population, that surely has got to be one of them.
I think it's really important that we do discuss these issues and do more than that, actually try to begin to formulate positive visions for the future, because if we're going to have a future, then we want it to be as positive as possible. And I must say, I mean, I suppose in closing, there are days when I think that, or fear rather, that how we're going to handle this is that we will adapt as best we can to adversity when it's forced upon us.
Well, if we just carry on ignoring the problem, we don't know how much adversity we're going to run up against. But sooner or later, if that's our approach to all the problems that we're going to encounter as a global society that burns through resources as fast as it can without much thought, then sooner or later we're going to encounter a very big problem, even if we were to stumble through the climate change one okay. So we've got to find a way of managing our impacts. I think that's as clear as daylight. But to frame it up as an inevitable doom and gloom thing is, I think we can do a bit better than that. I think if we really play our cards right, and I think if we're far-sighted enough and we've got enough vision, and I don't think enough positive vision, I think you're right, not enough positive visioning happens around this. But if we really think a bit inventively about all this, we are pursuing an opportunity agenda just as much as we're heading off a threat.
Well, Mike, once again, the book, The Burning Question, which is co-authored with Duncan Clark. Now, that's widely available, all the usual outlets, as they say. And you've also got a website for that, burningquestion.info. Is there anything else you'd like to share with listeners about the book or your work?
Well, it's our attempt to get some macro perspectives out there and get some big picture thinking all in one place in an accessible book. And we think that everyone who's serious, every serious politician in the world needs to understand the issues in the book. So we're going to give a copy to every MP and peer in the next couple of months and see if we can get to the point at which everyone who's in UK politics has got no excuse for not understanding at least the macro dynamics of this.
Excellent. Well, Mike Berners-Lee, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
That was the Radio EcoShock summer edit of the Legalize Freedom podcast, this time with Mike Berners-Lee and The Burning Question. Find out more about the book at www.burningquestion.info. You may also be interested in Greg Moffat's interview with controversial Deep Green author Paul Kingsnorth. It's called The Myth of Progress. Find it all at Greg's legalizefreedom.com website. Be sure to use the British spelling of legalize with an S. There is a dash between legalize and freedom. Or grab that link, legalizefreedom.com, from my own show blog at ecoshock.info. It's all there, ecoshock.info. Maybe it is holiday time, but the atmosphere keeps on changing, dragging the climate to places humans have never experienced. Join us for the ride at Radio EcoShock, and feel free to support our program at the website, ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening and for warming up to the idea of a big, big social change. I'm Alex Smith. This has been Radio EcoShock. This is the Canadian group Mother Mother from their new album, Styx, In the Latter Days.